Hello and welcome to the Gustavo Franco Podcast, where we explore the multifaceted world of healthcare. I'm your host, Gustavo Franco, a passionate healthcare student and an aspiring physician. Our mission is to better understand the U.S. healthcare system while studying both its flaws and strengths, as well as comparing it to other healthcare systems around the globe. Not only do we examine the policies and regulations behind healthcare, but we also take a closer look at the experiences of patients and doctors within the system. We aim to provide listeners with a deeper understanding of how healthcare truly operates. We share stories of individuals navigating the U.S. healthcare system, as well as present engaging interviews with professionals offering their experiences and expertise to help us understand the inner workings of healthcare. We believe that an informed public is the key to creating a more effective healthcare system, and we dedicate ourselves to this mission, providing insight and analysis on the ever-changing landscape of the U.S. healthcare system. Join us every month as we embark on a journey of studying healthcare together. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are ours and of our guests and do not constitute any professional advice. While we strive to be as accurate as possible, we acknowledge that there are often many viewpoints on a topic and our research may not be exhaustive. Therefore, we encourage listeners to engage with the subject matter and conduct their own research and confirm any information before making any decisions. Thank you for listening and joining us on this healthcare exploration. Welcome to this month's episode of the Gustavo Franco Podcast, where we'll discuss social determinants of health. Have you ever thought about what else besides your genetic code and lifestyle choices can help determine your health outcomes? Well, that is exactly what we're going to be discussing in this episode. Social determinants of health are non-medical factors that we cannot directly control. They're often described as the wider set of forces that have an impact in our daily lives and health outcomes. Did you know that your zip code can be the strongest predictor of your health, even more than your genetic code or lifestyle choices, depending on where you live? According to county health rankings, if you're born in Oglala Lakota County in South Dakota, you can expect to have a life expectancy of 62.8 years. While if you're born in Mono County in California, you can expect to live to over 100 years old. That's nearly a 40-year difference in life expectancy, solely based on the zip code that you're born in. In this episode, we'll explore why this is. What besides lifestyle choices and genetics can be used to determine your health outcomes? The answer is social determinants of health. While both these counties may have significant genetic differences and lifestyle factors, such as smoking rates, they also differ significantly in income, race, education level, and much more that we're going to be discussing here. However, as we go through this episode, it's crucial to understand what we actually mean when we say that race can be a social determinant of health. It's not a matter of biology. There are no inherent biological differences that predispose any race to worse health outcomes. Instead, we're talking about the societal constructs and systemic inequalities that lead to disparities in health. Prejudices, discrimination, and unequal access to resources contribute to these health gaps. So when we talk about race in this context, we're really talking about the social, economic, and environmental barriers that people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds face, not the color of their skin or any supposed biological differences. So please keep this in mind as we go through the episode. When looking at income by itself, the richest man in the U.S. can expect to live at least 15 years longer than the poorest man in the U.S. While men in the top 1% live to be 87.3 years old, men in the bottom 1% live to be 72.7 years old. And that is only data looking at life expectancy from 2001 to 2014. These numbers are definitely even more extreme now because the same study that looked at this data found that there was a massive inequality in life expectancy increases over time. While life expectancy increased by 2.34 years for men in the top 1% from 2001 to 2014, it only increased by 0.32 years for men in the bottom 1%. So if the same trend continues as we saw from 2001 to 2014, even though the life expectancy gap was 14.6 years for men in the top 1% and bottom 1% in 2014, we can expect the gap to be well over 15 years now. The same trend follows for women, who had a life expectancy gap of 10.1 years between the top 1% and the bottom 1% in 2014. But they saw an even greater disparity in life expectancy increase, with women in the top 1% seeing a 2.91 increase in life expectancy from 2001 to 2014, while women in the bottom 1% only saw an increase of 0.04 years. Income is one of the most significant determinants of health in the US and globally, and we'll explore more about this as we go through the podcast. Education also significantly determines your health outcomes. According to a study by Robert A. Humer and Joseph T. Larisky in the International Book of Adult Mortality, relative to those with 17 or more years of education, those that only got between 9 and 11 years of education have a mortality rate that is 202% higher for the age group between 25 and 44 years old. That means that mortality rate is more than tripled for those with 9 to 11 years of education as compared to those with 17 or more years of education. But keep in mind, that's for the age group between 25 and 44 years old. The same difference was significant across all age groups based on age. However, it's not as severe for older groups. This is likely a result of education having a more significant impact on the highly preventable causes of death, such as lung cancer from smoking, respiratory distress, homicides, and accidents. The overall mortality rate in younger groups is not that high because younger people are less likely to have all of the debilitating conditions that come with old age. So, if one of these groups is more likely to partake in high-risk activities with terrible health outcomes, such as those people that did not get as many years of education, they are more likely to partake in activities such as smoking, and then the difference is going to be more significant than groups at older ages, because at older ages, the age catches up to everyone, and all groups suffer from many more complications. So at a younger age, people with a lower level of education attainment are more likely to die from highly preventable causes of death, such as smoking. So the level of education attainment not only decreases mortality rates and increases life expectancy, but it also improves overall quality of life. And that is something that we're going to be discussing in detail in this episode. Lastly, before diving into the episode, I want to highlight a few statistics about race as a determinant of health, because some of these statistics are truly disheartening. Take maternal mortality in the US, for example. In 2021, Black women had a maternal mortality of 69.9 for every 100,000 births, while white women had a maternal mortality of 26.6 for every 100,000 births, making Black women 2.5 times more likely to die from birth than white women. Maternal health is a topic for its own episode, with numerous social inequalities and with truly disappointing outcomes in the US that pale in comparison to every other country. And worst of all, these outcomes have only been getting worse in the US in the past years. And that's just a small glimpse of racial disparities in health. Race by itself was also a significant determinant of health during COVID. Take life expectancy, for example. It's well known that overall life expectancy decreased in the US because of COVID, but many people forget to look at how different races were affected. Overall life expectancy went from 78.8 years in 2019 to 76.1 years in 2021, a 2.7 year decrease in life expectancy. But while whites and Asians saw a 2.4 and a 2.1 year decrease in lifespan, Blacks had a 4-year decrease in life expectancy, and Hispanics had an even more significant 4.2 year decrease in life expectancy. And then we have the Alaskan Natives, who were affected the most, with a mind-blowing 6.6-year decline in life expectancy due to COVID. These numbers show that social determinants of health are a real thing and something that we should all be aware of. As we move into the main part of the episode, we will dive further into each of these social determinants of health and how we can pull them apart and analyze them individually. We'll also talk about a key aspect of social determinants of health, and that is how we can actually improve on them and address them. So lean back and enjoy this ride into the world of social determinants of health. First off, you might be wondering, what exactly are social determinants of health? The World Health Organization defines them as the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. These circumstances are shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources at global, national, and local levels. To put it simply, as I said before, it's not just about our genes or our personal choices. It's about the environment around us, the opportunities available to us, and the societal structures that influence our lives. Vicente Navarro, in his paper, What We Mean by Social Determinants of Health, emphasizes the distinction between individual determinants and social determinants. While our personal behaviors, like diet and exercise, play a role in our health, there are broader societal and economic structures that influence those behaviors. It's these structures that we're focusing on today. And here's an interesting fact. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the CDC, and the Healthy People Initiative 2030 have categorized these determinants into five key areas. 1. Economic stability. 2. Education access and quality. 3. Social and community context. 4. Healthcare access and quality. And 5. Neighborhood and the built environment. We'll be diving into each of these buckets throughout the episode. But before we delve further, it's essential to understand that while the healthcare system plays a crucial role in our health, broader societal interventions are necessary to truly make a difference. But before we delve further, it's essential to understand that while the healthcare system plays a crucial role in our health, broader societal interventions are necessary to truly make a difference. As Navarro poignantly stated in his paper, medicine is a social science, and politics is nothing more than medicine on a larger scale. So as we navigate today's episode, let's remember that health isn't just about medicine. It's about the world that we live in, the opportunities that we have, and the societal structures that shape our lives. As we delve deeper into the world of social determinants of health, it's crucial to understand the five key areas that shape our health outcomes. These areas, as I mentioned, are recognized by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the HHS, the CDC, and the Healthy People Initiative 2030, to provide a comprehensive framework for understanding the myriad factors that influence our health. Let's break them down one by one. First up, economic stability. This area encompasses factors like income, employment, job security, and debt. The Kaiser Family Foundation highlights the significance of socioeconomic status in determining health outcomes. Simply put, financial stability, or the lack thereof, can have profound effects on one's health, from stress-related illnesses to limited access to nutritious food or safe housing. Next, we have education access and quality. It's not just about the degrees you hold, but also about health literacy, early childhood education, and vocational training. A well-educated individual is more likely to make informed decisions, have better access to healthcare, and even live longer. The third area is social and community context. This dives into the essence of our human interactions, our social integration, support systems, and community engagement. But it also touches on the darker aspects of society, like discrimination and racism. Our sense of belonging, the support we receive, and the societal biases we face can all play pivotal roles in our mental and physical well-being. Of course, we also can't go without discussing healthcare access and quality. While we often think of this in terms of having a good doctor or hospitals nearby, it's also about health coverage, provider availability, and health literacy. As highlighted by the Kaiser Family Foundation once again, access to quality healthcare is a cornerstone of good health. Lastly, we have neighborhood and the built environment. This is where we live, the safety of our communities, the parks we relax in, and the walkability of our streets. It also touches on the concept of food deserts, areas where access to fresh, healthy options are limited. Our surroundings, from the air we breathe to the safety of our streets, play a crucial role in our health. These five areas provide a holistic view of the myriad factors that shape our health. It's not just about individual choices, but the environment and society that we're a part of. As we navigate today's episode, we'll delve deeper into each of these areas, shedding light on their significance and the ways we can address the challenges that they present. Having explored these five key areas of social determinants of health, a natural question arises. How do we differentiate between what counts as a social determinant of health and what doesn't count? This distinction is crucial for understanding the depth and breadth of a topic. Once again, Vicente Navarro's paper, What We Mean by Social Determinants of Health, offers a deeper dive into this topic. He distinguishes between the conditions we might control, like our personal diet or exercise routine, and the broader societal conditions that influence these choices. Imagine two individuals. One has the means to buy fresh produce, has the time to cook, and lives in a neighborhood with safe walking paths. The other lives in a food desert, where fresh food is scarce, he works two jobs, and he has no safe recreational space nearby. While both have a choice in their diet, the societal conditions heavily influence these choices. Navarro provides a striking example from East Baltimore. The vast difference in lifespan between a black unemployed youth and a white corporate lawyer isn't just about personal choices. It's a reflection of broader societal structures, from economic disparities to systemic discrimination. This example brings forth an essential aspect of social determinants of health, their interconnectedness. Social determinants of health aren't isolated silos. They often overlap and intersect in complex ways. The black unemployed youth in East Baltimore doesn't just face economic challenges. He might also be grappling with limited access to quality education, inadequate healthcare facilities, and a neighborhood environment that's not conducive to good health. Each of these determinants compounds the other, creating a web of challenges that can be daunting to navigate. And even though he faces all of these challenges, he still has some sort of choice when it comes to his diet and exercise routine, but these choices are way more limited than for the white corporate lawyer. So that is something that we must keep in mind, that even though people with different social determinants of health have some sort of freedom in their lifestyle choices, these are still highly connected with their social determinants of health. Similarly, going back to the white corporate lawyer, while he enjoys economic stability, he might still face challenges in other areas, such as mental health pressures from working a high-stress job or limited social support. It's crucial to understand that individuals often experience multiple social determinants simultaneously, and these determinants can either amplify each other's effects or provide a counterbalance. The Kaiser Family Foundation insights resonate with this. Socioeconomic status isn't just about one's bank balance. It's about societal structures that determine access to resources, education, and opportunities. In essence, our lives are a mosaic of these determinants. Recognizing their interconnected nature helps us appreciate the complexity of challenges many face and underscores the need for holistic solutions that address multiple determinants simultaneously. Navarro's emphasis on the role of politics in medicine is also super thought-provoking. If we consider politics as medicine on a larger scale, it underscores the profound impact of policy decisions on our collective health, and that's a great way of thinking of social determinants of health. It's not just about healthcare policies, but about housing, education, labor rights, and more. In essence, while our individual choices play a role in our health, they're often a product of societal structures we're embedded in. Recognizing and addressing the structures is pivotal for holistic health improvements. As we continue our journey today, we'll delve deeper into these societal structures, understanding their intricacies and the profound impact that they have on our health. Having delved into the intricacies of social determinants of health in the US, it's essential to zoom out and understand the global landscape. The challenges and opportunities presented by social determinants of health are not unique to any one country. They're a shared human experience. Consider this. A family in the top 1% in Tanzania might enjoy relative affluence in their local context, with access to private education, healthcare, and a comfortable home. Contrast this with a family in the bottom 1% in the US, who, compared to the family in the top 1% in Tanzania, makes relatively the same income, but yet in the US, this income is a lot different, because these people here might face challenges accessing basic healthcare, nutritious food, or safe housing. The societal context that they're in heavily influences their health outcomes, and not just the hard income that they make. So it's important to note that social determinants of health are going to have differences and similarities when you take a global perspective. Yet, in this case, both families, despite their economic disparities, might also face similar challenges in terms of social integration, community support, or facing systemic biases. So it's not right to just look at one social determinant of health. We must look at it in a holistic manner. Michael Marmot, and Richard Wilkinson in their book Social Determinants of Health, The Solid Facts, emphasized the universality of these social determinants. Whether in Europe, Africa, or the Americas, the societal structures that influence health outcomes remain consistent. The manifestations might differ, but the underlying principles remain the same. Here's an example of these disparities in health at a global level. A girl born in Sweden can expect a long, healthy life with access to world-class healthcare, education, and social support. Contrast this with a girl born in Sierra Leone, where the challenges of infectious diseases, limited healthcare infrastructure, and socioeconomic challenges might significantly reduce her expected lifespan. These disparities aren't just statistics. They represent a moral imperative. As global citizens, understanding and addressing these disparities is our shared responsibility. It's not just about charity or aid. It's about creating a world where every individual, regardless of their birthplace, has an equal opportunity to lead a healthy, fulfilling life. In the words of Marmot and Wilkinson, health inequalities are not just a matter of personal choice or bad luck. They're a matter of social justice. As we continue our exploration of social determinants of health, let's keep this global perspective in mind, recognizing the shared challenges and opportunities that bind all of us. In this next segment, we're going to break down those five key buckets of social determinants of health that we had discussed earlier. And once again, this is a mutually exclusive model used by the Healthy People Initiative with the Department of Health and Human Services, and it is also used by the World Health Organization and the CDC. The model includes 1. Economic stability, 2. Education access and quality, 3. Social and community context, 4. Healthcare access and quality, and 5. Neighborhood and the built environment. So let's really dive deep into what each of these mean and how they impact our health. First, let's start off with economic stability. Economic stability is a true cornerstone of well-being, but it's important to know that economic stability isn't just about the dollars and cents. It's about employment, income, and stress, and how each of these intricately link to our health and longevity. Let's start with income's role in health. A comprehensive study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, conducted by researchers including Chetty and their colleagues, sheds light on this relationship. The paper, titled The Association Between Income and Life Expectancy in the U.S. Between 2001 and 2014, provides a detailed analysis of how income affects life expectancy. The findings are stark. In the U.S., between 2001 and 2014, high income was consistently associated with greater longevity. This wasn't just a minor difference. As I mentioned in the intro, these disparities in life expectancy across income groups have been increasing. But what's even more intriguing is that this association varies across different geographical areas. Moving on to employment and health, stable employment does more than just provide a paycheck. It offers a sense of purpose, social connections, and importantly, access to health benefits. Conversely, unemployment and underemployment can lead to stress, mental health issues, and deferred healthcare. The same study that I just mentioned found correlations between life expectancy and local area characteristics. For instance, areas with a higher fraction of college graduates and higher median household values were associated with increased life expectancy, especially for those in the bottom income quartile. Lastly, let's delve into financial stress and chronic disease. Financial stress isn't just about feeling anxious at the end of the month. It's about tangible physiological effects. Chronic financial stress can lead to conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and mental health disorders. The stress of deciding between paying a medical bill or rent, for instance, can exacerbate all of these health conditions. That same study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association also highlighted the negative correlation between life expectancy and the rates of smoking and obesity, especially among individuals in the bottom income quartile. These health behaviors, often influenced by financial stress and socioeconomic conditions, play a significant role in determining life expectancy. In conclusion, economic stability is a multifaceted determinant of health. It's not just about the money in our bank, but about the broader societal structures that determine our access to resources, opportunities, and ultimately our health outcomes. But before leaving economic stability behind, and to further underscore the profound relationship between economic stability and health, let's turn our attention to East Asia, specifically Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand. A research paper titled Economic Stability and Health Status, Evidence from East Asia Before and After the 1990s Economic Crisis, authored by Sandra Hopkins and published in the journal Health Policy, provides invaluable insights into this relationship. The late 1990s were tumultuous times for the East Asian economies. Their growth rates, which had been soaring in the early 1990s, took a sharp downturn. The Asian financial crisis began with the depreciation of regional currencies against the US dollar, leading to capital outflows, widespread bankruptcy, and unemployment. Let's delve into some of the specifics. In Indonesia, the GDP declined by a staggering 13.1% in 1998. This economic downturn was accompanied by a massive decline in the value of the rupiah, leading to an 83.6% increase in the food price index. It's estimated that 13.4 million workers lost their jobs by June 1998, and the percent of the population living in poverty surged from 17% to 40%. Thailand, too, faced economic challenges. In 1998, its real GDP growth rate declined by 10.5%. However, by the following year, it rebounded with a growth rate of 4.4%. Despite the significant depreciation of the baht, Thailand's currency, the impact on prices was relatively modest, with the consumer price index increasing by 8.5% in 1998. These economic fluctuations had direct implications for health. As household incomes declined, families were forced to cut back on essential expenditures, including food and healthcare. This led to health challenges such as malnutrition and low birth weight. Moreover, with reduced tax revenue, governments found it challenging to maintain health and education expenditures. This decline in public health spending limited the ability to provide essential health services such as universal immunization. And it's by no surprise that mortality rate increased in these areas during this time. But it's not just about increased mortality and decreased incomes. We must also consider the financial and economic stress that came with this period. For example, the Thai Ministry of Health reported that the suicide rate for men jumped from 5.01 per 100,000 people in 1996 to 8.05 in 1999. The paper's findings emphasized the importance of social safety nets and the need to maintain government expenditure during economic downturns to minimize the impact on health. It's a stark reminder that economic policies and health outcomes are deeply intertwined. Drawing parallels with our earlier discussion on the US, it becomes evident that whether in developed nations like the US or developing economies like those in East Asia, economic downturns can have profound implications on health outcomes. The East Asian experience shows the need for robust economic policies and safety nets to ensure the well-being of populations during economic challenges. Now, let's turn our attention to another crucial determinant of health. Education. Education plays a pivotal role in shaping our health outcomes, and today we'll explore this intricate relationship. Firstly, let's discuss the direct link between education levels and health outcomes. Numerous studies have shown that individuals with higher education levels tend to have better health outcomes. For instance, a child born to parents who haven't completed high school is more likely to live in an environment with barriers to health, such as a lack of safety, exposed garbage, and substandard housing. They might also lack access to essential amenities like sidewalks, parks, or libraries. This brings us to the concept of health literacy. Health literacy is the ability to obtain, read, understand, and use healthcare information to make appropriate health decisions and follow instructions for treatment. Higher education levels often correlate with better health literacy, enabling individuals to make informed decisions about their health. This, in turn, can lead to better health outcomes. I've recorded a full one-hour episode on just health literacy, so make sure to check that out since it goes a lot more in-depth into this issue of health literacy. But I also want this to serve as an example as to how deep these concepts within the social determinants of health really are. Within the bucket of education, we talk about health literacy here just for a couple of minutes, but I've also been able to record a full 1-hour episode on it. And still, I wasn't able to get all of the information across. But this here just shows that these topics are really way more complicated. So if any of them interest you, make sure to do your own research on them, since there's a lot more to learn. Or just let me know if there's a specific topic that you would like me to go into more detail, and I can do another episode just on that. Now, going back to education, let's delve into the realm of early childhood education. Early childhood education plays a pivotal role in shaping the future health of individuals. Providing quality early education to children in low-income families and communities of color help reduce achievement gaps, improve the health of these students, and promote health equity. It's not just about academic achievements, it's about laying the foundation for a healthier future. To further emphasize the importance of education in determining health outcomes, let's delve into a research paper titled Beyond Healthcare: The Role of Social Determinants in Promoting Health and Health Equity. This paper, published in the journal Health Policy, provides a comprehensive analysis of the relationship between various determinants, including education, and the health outcomes. The paper highlights that while healthcare is essential, it's a relatively weak health determinant. Health behaviors, such as diet and exercise, are significant determinants of premature death. However, there's growing recognition that social and economic factors shape individuals' abilities to engage in the healthy behaviors. In conclusion, education is not just about academic achievements. It plays a pivotal role in shaping our health outcomes and overall well-being. Ensuring access to quality education, especially in the early years, can lay the foundation for a healthier future. But before moving on to social and community context, I want to discuss two papers from scientific journals on the topic of education as a social determinant of health. Our first paper is titled Education, A Missed Opportunity for Public Health Intervention by Allison Klebanoff-Cohen and S. Leonard Syme. This paper, published in the American Journal of Public Health, delves into how education attainment, a well-established social determinant of health, affects health through various mechanisms such as neurodevelopment, biological aging, health literacy, and more. The authors emphasize that education, ranging from preschool to higher school, is a social determinant of health with clear policy pathways for intervention. They reviewed various education stages and identified which components are essential for good health outcomes. This is great because it encompasses the whole spectrum of education that we just covered. It also discusses key metrics that have been shown to affect education and, therefore, health outcomes. Let's start with early childhood education. Researchers from diverse fields, including economics and neurobiology, have identified early childhood as a pivotal time in human development. High-quality early childhood programs, such as the Perry Preschool and the Carolina Abecedarian Project, have shown to produce better health outcomes and behaviors in adulthood. Key markers of high-quality programs include small classes, well-trained teachers, school-family partnerships, and methods consistent with elementary school experiences. All of these have shown to ingrain children with healthy habits, and these, if set at an early age, can remain with them for the rest of their lives. Moving on to kindergarten through 12th grade education, transformative policies like desegregation have been linked to improved school quality for non-white students, leading to better self-rated health. State policies that raise the dropout age have also shown to increase students' educational attainment, subsequently boosting their earnings in adulthood and improving their health. Additionally, smaller class sizes in elementary school have been associated with positive cognition and academic outcomes. In the realm of higher education, the relationship between educational attainment and health appears to be non-linear. A bachelor's degree in particular is associated with a myriad of health benefits, possibly due to its contribution to social and economic stratification. As more people attend college, the quality and reputation of the institution become increasingly significant sources of differentiation. This paper underscores the importance of high-quality education across an individual's academic journey and how every aspect of education has an impact in health outcomes. Our next paper that we're going to be discussing is related to education and health outcomes and is titled Education and Health: Evaluating Theories and Evidence. This paper, authored by David M. Cutler and Adriana Lleras-Mune was published in the National Bureau of Economic Research. Cutler and Lleras-Mune's research provides a robust examination of the various theories that attempt to explain the connection between education and health. They delve into the mechanisms that might underlie this relationship, exploring factors such as income, health behaviors, and social networks. One of the standout findings from this research is the strong correlation between educational attainment and health outcomes. The authors highlight that individuals with more education tend to have better health outcomes, and this isn't just about the income. Even after accounting for income differences, the health benefits of education remain evident. The paper also delves into the role of health behaviors. It found that those with more education are less likely to smoke, more likely to exercise, and have healthier diets. These behaviors, in turn, have a direct impact on our health outcomes, emphasizing the importance of education in shaping health-related behaviors. Another fascinating aspect that the authors touch upon is the social and psychological benefits of education. Those with higher educational attainment often have better social networks, a greater sense of control over their lives, and higher levels of psychological well-being. These factors, while not directly health-related, play a significant role in influencing overall health and well-being. Cutler and Lleras-Mune also discuss the potential policy implications of their findings. They suggest that interventions aimed at increasing educational attainment could have significant health benefits. By understanding the pathways through which education affects health, policymakers can design more effective interventions that target the root cause of health disparities. As we delve deeper and deeper into the social determinants of health, we now turn to the intricate realm of social and community context. This determinant is a mosaic of our relationships, interactions, and the broader societal structure that influence them. And I'll be honest from the beginning, this is a rather broad bucket of health determinants, and it's sometimes hard to determine whether or not a certain principle fits into this category. I'll do my best to keep everything plain and simple. According to Healthy People 2030, our interactions with family, friends, coworkers, and community members can profoundly shape our health. But it's not just about these direct interactions. It's also about the societal and systematic factors that influence them. One such factor is race. Race and the associated experiences of discrimination and systemic racism play a pivotal role in our health and well-being. For instance, communities of color often face systemic barriers that can lead to health disparities. These barriers can range from limited access to quality healthcare and education to living in neighborhoods with limited resources and higher levels of pollution. Discrimination, whether based on race, gender, sexual orientation, or other factors, can have detrimental effects on mental and physical health. Chronic stress from facing discrimination can lead to conditions like hypertension, anxiety, and depression. But the social and community context isn't just about the challenges, it's also about the resilience, support, and community cohesion. Positive relationships, whether at home, work, or within the community, can act as protective factors, buffering against the negative impacts of discrimination and other challenges. Imagine living in a neighborhood where you don't feel safe walking outside, or you're facing discrimination daily because of your race, gender, or beliefs. These challenges, which many people face, can have detrimental effects on health and safety throughout life. On the flip side, positive relationships, whether at home, work, or within the community, can act as a buffer against these negative impacts. A supportive friend or a caring neighbor can make all the difference in someone's life, especially during challenging times. So if I can ask you and all of the other listeners here for one thing, is to care for the health of those around you. Check in with them. Make sure that they feel included, and make sure that they feel healthy. This will help ensure that everyone feels supported. However, not everyone is fortunate enough to have this support system. Consider children whose parents might be incarcerated or adolescents who face bullying. These individuals often lack the social and community support that is so crucial for mental and physical well-being. Here, it's also essential to understand that not all experiences fit neatly into this category. For instance, while race and experiences of discrimination are part of the social and community context, individual health behaviors like diet and exercise might not directly fit into this category. They are certainly influenced by it, but are often considered separate from social determinants of health. Building on our discussion about the social and community context of health, I would like to delve deeper into a seminal research paper that provides a comprehensive look at the intersection of race, discrimination, and health outcomes among African Americans. The paper we're discussing here today is titled Race, Race-Based Discrimination, and Health Outcomes Among African Americans. The paper is authored by Vicky Mace, Susan Cochran, and Namdi Barnes, and it was published in the esteemed Annual Review of Psychology. This research is particularly significant as it delves into the persistent health disadvantages faced by African Americans, a topic that is intricately tied to the broader societal and community context we've been discussing. One of the most startling revelations from this study is the profound health disparities that exist. To put into perspective, in the 1990s, an African-American male residing in Harlem had a lower likelihood of reaching the age 65 than the average male in Bangladesh. This is a stark reminder of the deep-seated health disparities that can exist even within developed nations. The paper doesn't just stop presenting these disparities, it delves into the why. Why do such profound health disparities exist? The researchers hypothesize that continuous experiences of racism and discrimination may be at the root of many of these health disparities. For instance, the overall death rate for African Americans today is equivalent to that of whites in America 3 decades ago. This is evident in diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular heart disease, hypertension, and obesity. But how does discrimination translate into these health outcomes? The paper provides some insights. Chronic experiences like race-based discrimination, both actual and perceived, can trigger psychological responses. Think elevated blood pressure and heart rate. Over time, the psychological responses can lead to diseases and ultimately higher mortality. The study also underscores the importance of understanding the external influences of social space and the internal effects of body and brain functioning. With the advancements in neuroscience and biology, there is a growing body of evidence that shows the intricate relationships between discrimination, brain function, and other health outcomes. In wrapping up our discussion on this paper, it's evident that while strides have been made in addressing race-based civil rights, the health disparities rooted in discrimination remain a significant concern. As we continue our journey into understanding the social determinants of health, it's crucial to recognize these disparities and work towards creating a more inclusive and supportive environment for all. As we continue our exploration of the social determinants of health, we now turn our attention to a critical pillar, health and healthcare. Access to quality healthcare is a fundamental right, yet disparities persist, affecting the health outcomes of countless individuals. According to Healthy People 2030, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine defined access to healthcare as the timely use of personal health services to achieve the best possible health outcomes. Yet, many face barriers that limit or even prevent them from accessing these essential services, leading to poor health outcomes and pronounced health disparities. Across the U.S., disparities in health access are evident. Whether it's due to geographical constraints, socioeconomic factors, or other barriers, these disparities can have profound implications. For instance, a person living in a rural area might have to travel hours to see a specialist, while someone in an urban setting might have multiple specialists only within a few miles. Health insurance is also a significant factor in healthcare access. Inadequate health insurance is one of the largest barriers. The unequal distribution of coverage contributes to health disparities. Out-of-pocket medical costs can lead individuals to delay or even forego essential care. Medical debt is a reality for many, both insured and uninsured. And here's a startling fact. Minority groups account for over half of the uninsured population. The implications: uninsured adults are less likely to receive preventative services for chronic conditions. Children without health insurance are less likely to receive treatments or preventative services such as dental care or immunizations. Primary care is the front line in health. It's where early detection and prevention of diseases often occur. Studies have shown that having health insurance improves access to health services and better health monitoring. For instance, when previously uninsured adults become eligible for Medicare, their use of basic clinical services increases. However, health insurance is not the only barrier. limited availability of healthcare resources like physician shortages can lead to longer wait times and delayed care. And let's not forget about transportation. Inconvenient or unreliable transportation can interfere with consistent access to healthcare. Research has shown that individuals from racial and ethnic minority groups, especially those at increased risk for severe illnesses from COVID-19, were more likely to lack transportation to healthcare services. In wrapping up, while affordable health insurance is part of the solution, we must also consider economical, societal, cultural, and geographical barriers. New strategies are needed to increase the efficiency of healthcare delivery. As we continue our journey into understanding the social determinants of health, it's crucial to recognize these disparities and work towards creating a more inclusive and accessible environment for all. Now let's turn our attention to a critical area that often goes unnoticed: the neighborhood and the built environment. This encompasses everything from the houses we live in, the streets we walk on, to the air we breathe. Let's dive in. Starting with housing and health, the place we call home plays a pivotal role in our well-being. Living in substandard housing, which might have mold, pests, or inadequate heating, can lead to a range of health problems, from respiratory conditions to mental health issues. Moreover, housing insecurity, such as the threat of eviction or homelessness, can lead to chronic stress, which, as we know, has a myriad of negative health implications. Going a little more in depth, let's talk about the design and structure of our homes. These elements significantly influence housing quality and can affect both our mental and physical health. Poor housing conditions, such as the presence of lead, mold, or asbestos, can lead to chronic diseases and injuries. For instance, lead exposure, which can come from paint, pipes, or faucets, can have irreversible adverse health effects. Even at low levels, lead exposure can severely affect a child's nervous system and cognitive development. The temperature inside our homes also plays a critical role. Cold indoor conditions have been linked to high blood pressure, respiratory conditions, and even depression. On the flip side, homes that lack proper insulation or air conditioning can become unbearably hot, leading to heat-related illnesses. Water leaks in homes can lead to mold growth, which have been shown to affect respiratory health, increasing the likelihood of conditions like asthma. And let's not forget about safety features. The absence of smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors can be fatal. Overcrowding is another issue. Residents of overcrowded homes may face mental health challenges, food insecurity, and even infectious diseases. And these physical and structural conditions of housing disproportionately impact vulnerable groups, including children, older adults, individuals with physical disabilities, and those with lower income. Addressing housing quality as a public health issue can lead to better health outcomes. Housing codes and laws, such as those banning the use of lead paint, have already made a difference. Local building codes and state statutes have set basic standards for housing. Programs like the federal government's Housing Choice Voucher Program assist vulnerable populations in securing quality housing by requiring landlords to pass housing standards when renting the place out. Moving on to transportation and safety. Safe and accessible transportation is more than just a convenience. It's a lifeline. It's how we access healthcare, buy nutritious food, and engage in physical and social activities. A lack of reliable transportation can mean missed doctor's appointments or the inability to pick necessary medications. Furthermore, living in areas with high crime rates can deter outdoor physical activities and contribute to chronic stress. Historically, transportation policies have emphasized roads over public and active transportation. This has not only contributed to health hazards, but also segregated communities. However, introducing or expanding public transportation options can lead to improved health outcomes. This is achieved by promoting better air quality, increasing physical activity, reducing motor vehicle crashes, and improving mental health. Public transportation encompasses a wide range of options, from buses and streetcars to ferries and subways. But the history of public transportation in the U.S. has been shaped by various factors. Notably, the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 emphasized building national highway networks. This, combined with the rise of cars, led to a decline in public transportation infrastructure. And these highways often cut through communities of color, furthering racial and economic segregation. So who relies on public transportation? In 2019, about 5% of all U.S. workers commuted by public transportation. This number is higher in major cities like New York and San Francisco. Some groups, such as women, young adults, black workers, and low-income workers, rely more on public transportation, and a lack of access can disproportionately harm older people, people with disabilities, and communities of color. The health benefits of public transportation are numerous. Reduced vehicle miles lead to fewer motor vehicle crashes and less air pollution. And we know that air pollution can increase the risk of cancer and neurological diseases and can lead to damage to the cardiovascular, respiratory, reproductive, and immune systems. Moreover, public transportation provides access to health-promoting services, including healthcare itself. In fact, research has shown that the lack of transportation can result in missed healthcare appointments, leading to poorer health outcomes. But it's not just about the direct health benefits. Public transportation promotes physical activity when people walk to and from transit stops. Regular physical activity helps reduce the risk of chronic conditions, which disproportionately affect low-income communities and communities of color. Now I want to talk a little bit more about safety, because the mode of transportation you take and the places you go to are highly affected by the level of safety you feel. When people feel safe in their environment, they're more likely to walk or bike to their destinations. This not only promotes physical activity, but also ensures that they can access essential services like healthcare or grocery shopping. A study published in the esteemed journal Social Science and Medicine in 2016 sheds light on this very topic. Authored by J. Won, S. Lee, J. Forjong, and S. Ori, the paper is titled Neighborhood Safety Factors Associated with Older Adults' Health-Related Outcomes, a Systematic Literature Review. So what did this paper uncover about the intricate relationship between neighborhood safety and health? The study emphasizes that neighborhood safety isn't just about crime rates. It's multifaceted, encompassing overall perceptions of safety, crime-related concerns, traffic-related issues, and even visible signs of disorder like vandalism or graffiti. And how does this perception of safety, or lack thereof, affect the health of older adults? Well, great question. The research found that the general feeling of safety in a neighborhood was most relevant to mental health and physical function. Traffic-related safety, on the other hand, was more closely tied to physical activity. Think about it. If you're worried about speeding cars or lack of pedestrian crossings, you're less likely to take that evening walk or visit the local park. And when it comes to crime-related safety, it was consistently associated with mental health and walking habits. That's quite insightful, and it shows that it's not just about one's physical safety, but also about the mental toll that a perceived lack of safety can take. Lastly, the paper also highlights that while many studies have delved into neighborhood safety and its impact on older adults' health, there's still a need for more empirical evidence to solidify these links. But it's pretty evident that feeling safe in your neighborhood can only be a positive thing for your health. The overall feeling of safety reduces stress, which is highly related to health outcomes. And we can't forget once again that safety allows people to walk more freely in their neighborhoods, which increases physical activity and therefore improves health outcomes. Now, let's talk about the environment's role in health. The quality of our environment directly impacts our health. Living in areas with high pollution levels can exacerbate respiratory conditions like asthma and even lead to cardiovascular problems. On the flip side, access to green spaces not only promotes physical activity, but also has mental health benefits, providing a space for relaxation and recreation. This all influences the amount of time we spend outdoors. And we're going to explore a fascinating study that delves into this topic. That's right. The study we're discussing today is titled The Association Between Time Spent Outdoors and Myopia in Children and Adolescents, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This study was published in the Journal of Ophthalmology in 2012 and has some pretty insightful findings. Myopia, commonly known as nearsightedness, is a condition where distant objects appear blurry while close objects can be seen clearly. The prevalence of myopia varies worldwide, exceeding 80% in some East Asian populations. It's not just about blurry vision. High myopia can lead to severe visual impairment and even blindness. And while genetics play a role in the development of myopia, environmental factors have been believed to significantly influence its onset and progression. One such factor that has gained attention over the past decade is the amount of time children and adolescents spend outdoors. The study we're discussing today aimed to summarize and combine evidence from various studies to understand the association between time spent outdoors and the development of myopia. The researchers analyzed results from 7 cross-sectional studies, pooling their findings in a meta-analysis. And the results, quite intriguing. The pooled analysis indicated that for every additional hour spent outdoors per week, there was a 2% reduced odds of developing myopia. To put that in simpler terms, an extra hour outdoors each day could reduce the odds of myopia by about 14%. That's pretty significant. The study also highlighted that increasing time spent outdoors could be a simple strategy to reduce the risk of developing myopia and even its progression in children and adolescents. It's fascinating to think about that something as simple as spending time outdoors can have such a profound impact on our eye health. It emphasizes the importance of outdoor play and activities for children, not just for physical health, but also for their vision. And you might be asking why this happens. And the answer really lies on the physiology of your eyes. When light comes into the eyes, it hits cones and rods in the back of the eye. And while rods are in charge of perceiving light and making sense of objects, cones are really in charge of like putting color to those objects and their definition. So myopia really affects the cones of your eyes. When you are inside all of the time and looking at screens, your eyes adapt to that because they don't have to be seeing things far away. So the cones in the back of your eyes get longer and so does your eyeball, and myopia develops, and then your faraway vision becomes blurry. And what was found is that the children that were outside don't let their eyes adapt to the inside environment as well, because they're looking at the sky and other things super far away, but then they're also quickly switching the distance to look at things that are close to them, say a bug in their arm. This shift in the level of focus is really key to your eye health and to preventing myopia. But keep in mind, all of this that we talked about just now is just one aspect of health that benefits from spending more time outdoors. Lastly, I would like to talk about the concept of food deserts. A food desert is an area where residents have limited access to affordable and nutritious food. This isn't about the absence of food, but the absence of healthy food options. According to the USDA, 23.5 million people live in food deserts in the US. The implications: higher rates of nutritional-related diseases like obesity and diabetes. When the nearest grocery store is miles away and the corner store doesn't stock fresh produce, it becomes a challenge to maintain a healthy diet. But I want to dive a little deeper into this interesting concept because I think there are many misconceptions about it. To shed light on this, we're drawing from a comprehensive review titled Disparities and Access to Healthy Food in the United States, a review of food deserts literature, authored by Renee Walker, Christopher Keene, and Jessica Burke. Now, what's startling is that even when there's access to nutritious food, it doesn't always mean increased consumption, especially for low-income households. This could be due to various factors, including personal preferences and the actual presence or absence of a supermarket nearby. Interestingly, many residents feel a strong sense of loyalty to their local convenience stores. The introduction of a new supermarket can sometimes be seen as a threat to these smaller businesses, which play a pivotal role in the community. But here's where it gets concerning. In many neighborhoods that lack supermarkets, residents face a higher prevalence of health challenges where diet plays a significant role. We're talking about conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and even cancer. And when we talk about food choices, it's often influenced by what's available in the immediate vicinity. In many low-income urban areas, there's a higher density of fast food joints and corner stores offering prepared foods than in more affluent areas. This means more processed foods, more empty calories, and ultimately, poorer health choices. And the economics of this topic is pretty interesting too, because food deserts are created because more affluent areas are more profitable for supermarkets because people are more likely to come and spend. So supermarkets are more likely to be concentrated near those affluent areas. But that's enough about describing both social determinants of health. We've broken them down into five main buckets, these being 1, economic stability, 2, education, 3, social and community context, 4, health and healthcare, and lastly, 5, neighborhood and the built environment. And keep in mind that these buckets aren't just one social determinant of health. They're categories of social determinants of health with many social determinants of health within them. This was a very surface-level introduction to each of these social determinants of health. And the truth is that you can take on an entire career looking at just a single one of these. There's so much depth to all of it, and I've already done that for health literacy, so make sure to check that episode out. Also, I hope to go more in depth into race as a social determinant of health in next month's podcast episode with Dr. Christopher King, whose work has been monumental within the world of race and racism in healthcare. But now, I want us to think about what can be done about these issues. We talked about all of these factors that impact a person's health, but how can we actually address them, and what has already been done to address these issues and ensure healthcare equity and access? Honestly, this is a topic that I felt has always been missing from lectures and presentations until I saw it in one of my classes this semester. So I'll present to you most of the ways that I've found that social determinants of health can be addressed. And here I break them down again into 1, community engagement and empowerment, 2, technological innovations, 3, policy changes and advocacy, 4, public-private partnerships, 5, education initiatives, 6, built environment and urban planning, 7, economic interventions, and 8, cultural competence in healthcare. Let's dive right in. 1, community engagement and empowerment. At the forefront of addressing these unique needs are the voices of the community members themselves. Communities are not just clusters of homes or groups of people. They're living, breathing entities with unique needs, strengths, and challenges. And who knows them better than themselves? This idea actually brings me back to a story one of my professors once told me. She gave us the example of how a group from the US went into a small rural town in South Sudan to build them a water well. The thing is, this group never really took the time to survey the community and or asked for their input on what they wanted. So it turns out, after the water well was built, many women in the area were discontent because going to the nearby river with their friends to get water was their social activity and a way to have fun. Every time I hear about the importance of community voices, I remember this story, which truly underscores the importance of tailoring interventions for the community. No one intervention will look the same in different communities, and that is specifically true when it comes to interventions addressing social determinants of health. But let's take a step back. When we talk about community voices, what do we really mean? It's the collective insight, experiences, and aspirations of the people living in the particular area. These voices are the most authentic indicators of what a community truly needs. They provide a first-hand account of the challenges faced and the solutions that might work best. Let's consider another example. Imagine a neighborhood with a high rate of childhood obesity. While experts might suggest building a new gym or introducing a health program in schools, community voices might review that the real issue is the lack of safe playgrounds and the prevalence of fast food outlets. By listening, we can get to the root of the problem. Across the nation, we've seen numerous community-led initiatives making waves. Let's spotlight a few. In Detroit, Michigan, a city known for its resilience, the Detroit Community Academic Urban Research Center has been working hand-in-hand with local residents. Together, they have identified pressing health issues and developed strategies tailored to the community's needs. Their initiatives range from promoting physical activity to improving access to healthy foods. Moving to the West Coast in LA, the Community Coalition has been empowering residents to transform the social and economic conditions that foster addiction, crime, and violence. Through grassroots projects, they've successfully advocated for better housing, improved schools, and safer neighborhoods. These are just a couple of examples, but they highlight a crucial point. Solutions are most effective when they're rooted in the lived experiences of those they aim to serve. And I've been very happy to see this taking place here in Washington, D.C. I've been helping to gather data and community voices to write the 2024 Community Health Needs Assessment for MedStar Hospital, and it's truly fantastic to see everything that goes behind the report. Different neighborhoods, or wards as we call it in D.C., have extremely different community health needs. And although these are highlighted by hard data, like the prevalence of heart disease or child obesity in different areas, I learned the most about what communities really need by attending meetings with the community members to hear their voices. One critical thing I learned from these meetings was that community members love community health programs, but they will never be effective if there's no safety in the area and people don't feel safe walking to and from these programs. As we move forward in our series, remember this. Every community holds within it the seed for its own transformation. It's by nurturing the seeds, by listening and collaborating, that we can cultivate lasting change. 2. Technological innovations. Now I want to turn our focus to technological innovations, a rapidly growing field. First and foremost, let's talk about the digital tools and platforms that are making waves in the realm of public health. From AI-driven diagnostic tools to platforms that connect patients with resources, technology is playing a pivotal role in leveling the playing field. One of the most significant breakthroughs in recent years has been the rise of telemedicine. According to the CDC, in 2021 alone, a staggering 37% of adults reported using telemedicine in the past 12 months. Think about that for a moment. Over a third of adults turn to digital consultations, breaking down barriers of distance, mobility, and even time. Telemedicine isn't just about convenience. For those living in remote areas or for those who might not have easy access to specialist care, it's a lifeline. It bridges the gap between patients and providers, ensuring that quality care isn't just a privilege for those in urban centers or affluent neighborhoods. But the digital revolution doesn't stop there. Mobile apps and platforms are emerging as powerful tools in promoting health behaviors. Whether it's an app that reminds you to take your medication, a platform that connects you with mental health professionals, or even a game that encourages physical activity, technology is finding innovative ways to nudge us towards healthier choices. Consider this. There are apps today that can help manage chronic conditions, track nutrition, or even teach meditation and mindfulness. These tools, often right at our fingertips, empower individuals to take charge of their health, regardless of their socioeconomic status. As we look to the future, it's clear that technology will play an ever-increasing role in addressing the social determinants of health. By making healthcare more accessible, personalized, and proactive, we're not just improving individual lives, we're transforming communities. However, it's also important to note the limitations of these innovations. For example, many lack the access to devices or Wi-Fi to have telemedicine visits. But as these technologies evolve and new ideas come to market, I believe that accessibility and convenience will grow. 3. Policy changes and advocacy. Now let's consider how the government addresses social determinants. And to do that, we're going to discuss the policies and advocacy efforts that shape our health outcomes. Let's start by understanding the intricate web of health departments in the U.S. At the top, we have the National Health Department, which sets broad health objectives and strategies for the country. Then, at the state level, health departments tailor these national guidelines to the specific needs and challenges of their populations. And finally, at the grassroots, local health departments work on the front line, implementing these strategies in our communities. While they operate at different levels, these departments are interconnected. National initiatives often rely on state and local departments for execution, while local departments look to the state and national levels for guidance, resources, and support. But most importantly, they look at the community. It's a symbiotic relationship, with each level playing a crucial role in shaping our health outcomes. Now let's delve into the role of policies. Policies, whether they're set at a local, state, or federal level, have a profound impact on our health. Think about it. From the quality of the air we breathe to the safety of our neighborhoods, policies shape the world around us. Take, for instance, the Clean Air Act, a federal policy that has significantly reduced air pollution across the U.S. By setting emission standards, this policy has not only improved our environment, but has also led to fewer cases of respiratory illnesses and heart disease. On a state level, consider the policies around tobacco control. Many states have implemented higher taxes on tobacco products, leading to reduced consumption and, consequently, fewer tobacco-related diseases. At the local level, policies like zoning laws can determine where businesses like liquor stores or fast food chains can operate, influencing the community. But policies don't change in a vacuum. This is where advocacy and grassroots movements come into play. These are the voices that push for change, that highlight disparities, and that demand better health outcomes for all. Think about the grassroots movements that have pushed for healthier school lunches, or the advocates who have lobbied for more green spaces in urban areas. Their efforts, often starting at the community level, can ripple outwards, influencing local, state, and even national policies. In essence, advocacy bridges the gap between the lived experiences of individuals and the policies that affect them. It's a powerful tool, one that can drive meaningful, lasting change in our health outcomes. However, we cannot go without discussing how policies vary by counties. The truth is that while at the national level, entities like the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services set broad overarching goals and missions to tackle these determinants of health, there is a lot of leeway for states to tackle these goals in different ways. So different states have different programs and health standards, and local health departments play a very significant role on all health initiatives for the county. For instance, you could have two neighboring counties, one that just merely meets the state's health standards, and the other that goes above and beyond with local health department initiatives. And in these two counties, the difference in health outcomes is evident. So the takeaway here is that local health departments go a long way in addressing social determinants of health through local policies and grassroots movements. 4. Public-private partnerships. As we continue our exploration into the ways that we can address the social determinants of health, we are turning our attention to a powerful tool, public-private partnerships. Now, you might be wondering, what exactly are public-private partnerships? Simply put, they're collaborations between governments, nonprofit organizations, and private corporations. These partnerships harness the strengths of each sector to address complex health challenges. Imagine the scale and reach of a government initiative combined with the innovation and efficiency of the private sector and the community focus of nonprofits. That's the potential for public-private partnerships. Let's delve into some real-world examples to understand the impact of these collaborations. One of the most notable partnerships in recent years has been between the governments and tech companies to address health crises. Think about the collaborations during the COVID-19 pandemic, where tech giants appeared with health organizations to develop contact tracing apps, ensuring a swift response to outbreaks. But it's not just about responding to crises. These partnerships play a crucial role in preventative health too. Take, for instance, the collaboration between local governments and fitness companies to set up community fitness centers or outdoor gyms. These initiatives make it easier for communities to engage in physical activity, addressing the social determinant of health related to physical environments. Now let's talk about advocacy. Within these partnerships, private organizations, especially those with a health focus, often lobby for health policies. A prime example is the American Heart Association, or the AHA. They've been involved in numerous coalitions at both the state and national levels. The AHA's advocacy efforts have led to significant change, from regulations around tobacco and vaping to ensuring better nutrition in school meals. Their partnerships with both public entities and private corporations amplify their impact, driving change at a scale that would be challenging for any single entity to achieve. In essence, public-private partnerships represent the power of collaboration. By bringing together diverse stakeholders, these partnerships can address the root causes of health disparities, from the environments we live in to the policies that shape our lives. As we move through the segment, it's clear that addressing social determinants of health requires a multifaceted approach. Public-private partnerships offer a promising path forward, leveraging the strengths of each sector to drive meaningful change. 5. Education initiatives. Now let's turn our focus to education, which, remember, was one of the 5 big pillars of social determinants of health. So let's dive deep into the educational initiatives, specifically those aimed at increasing health literacy. Health literacy, once again, is the ability to understand and use information to make decisions about one's health. And in today's complex healthcare landscape, it's more important than ever. If you would like to learn more about it, be sure to check my episode about health literacy. Across the nation, there are numerous programs dedicated to this cause. One standout example is the Health Literacy Program for elementary school students. This initiative uses interactive lessons, games, and initiatives to teach children about nutrition, physical activity, and mental well-being. But it's not just about the individual. These programs recognize the importance of the community. By educating parents and caregivers alongside their children, we ensure that healthy behaviors learned in school are reinforced at home. After all, parents play a pivotal role in shaping their children's health choices. Moving on to school-based initiatives, there's a growing emphasis on creating environments that promote health from an early age. Schools are not just places for academic learning, they're hubs where children form lifelong habits. Take, for instance, the Farm to School program. This initiative connects schools with local farmers to provide fresh, nutritious meals in the cafeterias. But it goes beyond just food. The program incorporates lessons on nutrition, cooking classes, and even school gardens where students get hands-on experience growing their own food. Another transformative initiative is the Whole School, Whole Community, Whole Child model. This comprehensive approach integrates health into every aspect of the school experience, from physical education to mental health resources. It's a testament to the power of holistic education. As we reflect on the potential of educational initiatives, it's clear that they offer a multi-pronged approach to addressing social determinants of health. By instilling individuals with knowledge, we foster healthy environments and communities, and this way, we can pave the way to a healthier future. A key aspect that we cannot forget here is that education isn't just something we should have in childhood. It's a lifelong commitment, and so there should be health education efforts tackling all age groups. Innovative ways of education through, say, mobile apps or required health courses for corporations can truly change the mindset of many and help them care for their health and the health of those around them. 6. Built environment and urban planning. Another big bucket of social determinants of health that we discussed was the built environment. So I would like to talk a bit about initiatives for improving the built environment along with urban planning. As we discussed, the cities and neighborhoods we inhabit play a pivotal role in our health and well-being, from the air we breathe to the streets we walk. Every aspect of an environment influences our daily choices and, in turn, our health. Let's start with a fundamental question. How can we design cities and neighborhoods for health? The answer lies in integrating health considerations right from the inception of urban planning. Think of cities like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, where cycling lanes are as integral as the roads themselves, promoting physical activity and reducing vehicle pollution. But it's not just about transportation. The very layout of a city can promote health. Consider the concept of 15-minute cities. This urban planning initiative, piloted in cities like Paris, aims to ensure that residents can access most of their daily needs within a 15-minute walk or bike ride from their homes. This not only reduces the reliance on cars, but also fosters local businesses and community interactions. Now let's talk about green spaces. Parks, gardens, and even urban forests are the lungs of our cities. These offer spaces for recreation, relaxation, and connection with nature. Studies have shown that proximity to green spaces is linked to reduced stress, increased physical activity, and even improved mental well-being. But green spaces are just one piece of the puzzle. Walkability is another crucial aspect. Cities like Portland, Oregon, have invested heavily in pedestrian-friendly infrastructure. Wide sidewalks, safe crosswalks, and pedestrian zones not only make walking a pleasure, but also encourage residents to choose walking over driving for short distances. access to essential services is the cornerstone of a healthy urban environment. Imagine living in a neighborhood where healthcare facilities, grocery stores, schools, and recreational centers are all within easy reach. This not only reduces travel time and costs, but also ensures that residents have everything they need for a healthy life right at their doorstep. Before we wrap up here, let's touch on the importance of the clean air policies. Take the example of London's ultra-low emission zone, ULEZ. Introduced in 2019, this policy restricts the most polluting vehicles from entering the city center. Since its implementation, there's been a significant reduction in nitrogen dioxide levels, making the air cleaner and safer for residents. Such policies not only protect the environment, but also directly impact public health by reducing respiratory and cardiovascular diseases. The built environment and urban planning are powerful tools in addressing social determinants of health. By designing cities that prioritize health, we can create environments that nurture well-being, foster community, and pave the way for a brighter, healthier future. 7. Economic interventions. Now we'll go into the world of economic interventions, the first bucket of social determinants that we talked about. Money might not buy happiness, but economic stability can certainly pave the way for better health. Economic stability is a cornerstone of well-being. It affects where we live, what we eat, our stress levels, and even our access to healthcare. But how can we ensure that everyone has a fair shot of economic prosperity? Let's talk more about it. First on our list, job training and employment programs. These initiatives are designed to equip individuals with the skills they need to secure stable employment. Think of programs like Job Corps in the US, which offers free vocational training to young adults. By providing trainings in sectors like healthcare, manufacturing, and IT, such programs not only boost individual incomes, but also fill critical gaps in the workforce. But it's not just about the job skills. Employment programs often go hand in hand with soft skills training, teaching participants everything from resume writing to interview techniques. For instance, the Ear Up program connects urban young adults with companies in need of talent, ensuring they're job ready from day one. Now, while employment is crucial, it's just one piece of the economic puzzle. Financial stability also hinges on how we manage, save, and invest our money. And that's where microloans and financial literacy programs come into play. Microloan programs, popularized in countries like Bangladesh by the Grameen Bank, provide small loans to entrepreneurs who might not have access to traditional banking. These loans, often given to women, enable them to start or expand small businesses, often from handicrafts and livestock farming. The beauty of these programs, they not only boost individual incomes, but also uplift entire communities. But loans are just the beginning. Financial literacy is the key to long-term economic stability. Programs like Operation Hope in the US offer financial dignity and literacy training, teaching participants the basics of budgeting, saving, and investing. By empowering individuals with the knowledge to make informed financial decisions, we're laying the groundwork for a future free from economic disparities. It's clear that economic interventions have the power to transform lives. By providing individuals with the tools, skills, and knowledge they need, we're not just boosting incomes, we're paving the way for healthier, more prosperous communities. Economic interventions are a vital tool in our quest to address social determinants of health. Whether it's through job training, microloans, or financial literacy, these initiatives are reshaping the economic landscape, one individual at a time. While some of these ideas, such as giving loans and money to support those in economic distress, cost everyone a lot of money, others, like offering financial literacy classes or even free courses on healthcare spending, can lead to incredible change. 8. Cultural competence in healthcare. Last but definitely not least, I would like to discuss the role of cultural competence in healthcare to address social determinants. Imagine walking into a doctor's office and feeling misunderstood, not because of your symptoms, but because of your cultural background. This is a reality for many, and it's why cultural competence is so essential. First and foremost, what is cultural competence? It's the ability of healthcare providers to recognize and respect patients from diverse backgrounds and tailor care to meet their unique needs. It's not just about language, but understanding cultural customs, beliefs, and values. Let's start with training. It's essential for healthcare providers to understand cultural differences. Think about a scenario where a patient from a conservative background feels uncomfortable discussing health issues with a doctor of the opposite gender. Recognizing such nuances can make a world's difference in patient care. Institutions like the University of California in San Francisco have pioneered programs that immerse medical students in diverse communities. This hands-on experience helps future doctors understand the cultural and social challenges their patients might face. But training isn't just about exposure. It's about equipping healthcare providers with the tools to communicate effectively. This might mean using interpreters or understanding nonverbal cues specific to certain cultures. Now let's talk about tailoring healthcare services. It's not a one-size-fits-all scenario. Different communities have different healthcare needs, beliefs, and practices. For instance, traditional medicine plays a significant role in many cultures. A culturally competent healthcare provider would recognize this and find ways to integrate or acknowledge these practices in their treatment plans. Consider the success of the I Speak initiative in Seattle. This program ensures that patients receive medical information in their preferred language, making healthcare more accessible and understandable. Or think about clinics that adjust their hours to accommodate cultural or religious practices. A simple change, like being open after sunset during Ramadan, can make healthcare more accessible to Muslim patients. Cultural competence is more than just a buzzword. It's a commitment to understanding, respectful, and individualized care. It's about seeing the person behind the patient and ensuring that everyone, regardless of their background, receives the best possible care. In wrapping up, cultural competence is a journey, not a destination. As our world becomes more interconnected and diverse, the need for culturally competent care will only grow. It's up to us, whether we're healthcare providers or patients, to champion and demand this level of care. And this brings me to the end of my list of possible ways to address social determinants of health. I'm sure there are many more out there, and innovation's truly going to move us forward. So if you have any ideas that you think are really good, take them into action. It's never too early to drive change. And if you think about most change and most disruptive innovations, they all came from young people. So don't think that you have to wait up until you're deep into your career to make change, because that is never true. But to wrap up, I would like to repeat all of these ways of addressing social determinants of health that I just talked about. They are 1, community engagement and empowerment. 2, technological innovations. 3, policy changes and advocacy. 4, public-private partnerships. 5, education initiatives. 6, built environment and urban planning. 7, economic interventions. And 8, cultural competence in healthcare. But, ladies and gentlemen, as we draw this enlightening episode to a close, let's take a moment to reflect on the intricate web of factors that shape our health outcomes. From the economic stability of our households to the quality of education we receive, from the neighborhoods we grow in to the very air we breathe, every facet of our lives plays a role in determining our health. We've delved deep into the pressing issue of housing, transportation, access to nutritious food, and the undeniable influence of our built environment. We've explored the transformative power of technology in bridging healthcare gaps and the pivotal role of policies at each level. We've celebrated the success of community-led initiatives and the promise of public-private partnerships, and we've underscored the importance of cultural competence in healthcare, ensuring that every individual, regardless of their background, receives care that respects and understands their unique experiences. But here's the thing. While it's crucial to be informed, knowledge alone isn't enough. Change, real lasting change, requires action. And that's where each one of us comes in. Whether it's advocating for better policies, supporting community initiatives, or simply being more understanding and inclusive in our daily interactions, every small step counts. Improving the social determinants of health isn't just the responsibility of policymakers or healthcare professionals. It's a collective effort. So as you go about your day, remember, you have the power to make a difference, whether it's by supporting local initiatives, advocating for better policies, or simply educating others about the importance of these determinants. Every effort counts. Together, we can create communities where everyone has the opportunity to lead healthier, more fulfilling lives. Thank you for joining us on this journey today. Let's not just be listeners, let's be doers. Let's champion a world where health isn't just a privilege for a few, but a right for all. Until next time, stay informed, stay active, and stay healthy. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Gustavo Franco Podcast. We hope our exploration of the world of healthcare has been insightful and thought-provoking for you. Remember, the opinions expressed here are ours and of our guests and should not be considered professional advice. This podcast is a collaborative learning experience for both the producers and listeners. While we strive to convey accurate and up-to-date information, we acknowledge that our research may have limitations. We encourage all of our listeners to supplement their knowledge by conducting their own research. If you enjoyed this episode and want to stay up to date on our future releases, make sure to subscribe or follow us on your preferred podcast platform and social media. We highly value your feedback, so please don't hesitate to reach out with your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future topics. Thank you for joining us on this healthcare exploration. Together, we can foster a more educated America and contribute to a more effective healthcare future. Until next time, take care and stay informed.